We had this stack of photos to choose from for an album cover. And we all chose a couple, like Britt chose some, I chose some. I didn't choose that one. And I think Brian was the one that convinced us that that should be the album cover.
What did you want?
I wanted a different quarry. There was another quarry one. I did like it because we were smiling, but I also didn't know that that was going to be the end of the band. I think he knew that he was quitting. And So he probably wanted it as a statement.
Welcome to Discograffiti, the podcast that gives Gen X music maniacs a chance to smell like teen spirit again by connecting with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. I'm proud to say this is episode number 100. This show started totally as a lark and turned into a serious life mission for me. And I can say with great pride and total certainty that this show is absolutely here to stay. Within those 100 episodes, I've never missed a single week. Discograffiti's been rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally for a little while now, and I'm very appreciative to a very loyal audience for that having happened. So truly, from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank all of you who've connected with this show and understand that there's something deeper going on here than just learning about music. With that in mind, there was going to be no way in hell I was going to waste our centennial on some loser band. No way, no how. So in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on David Pajo. Part 4 of a very special 5-part Pajo series. Episode 4 brings the moment we've all been waiting for. Let's all admit it, Slint. Actually, I call episode 4 and 5 Slint and Such, meaning the two remaining episodes for all you fellow obsessives like me focus exclusively on Slint and related acts like Four Carnation and King Kong. And Pajo has consented to actually rating all of that material between 0 and 5 stars along with your host. That's right. This is a hot seat episode along with the next one. Look, if you know, then you know. But if you don't, then you're really in for a treat because tonight's guest was one of the founding fathers of emo and math rock with both Slint and Tortoise, not to mention his ludicrously prolific, insanely high-quality solo career, but just on their own, his collaborations with Billy Corgan, Bonnie Prince Billy, Gang of Four, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Interpol, Royal Trucks, and Stereolab would qualify the man as a Hall of Famer. David Pajo is a legend. In this episode of Discograffiti, Pajo reveals his thoughts on how Tweez would be regarded today if Spiderland had never been created, the broad wild stew of influences at play amongst the band when they recorded it, and exactly how many stars Pajo gives King Kong's movie star single, the Slint EP, and Tweez. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discograffiti is a music obsessive's dream come true. The guest and I explore their favorite band's entire discography in a futile but valiant effort to reach a higher truth. The show is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all. The real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Be sure to follow along with us chronologically as we go. The link to our legendary playlist is right there in the show notes. Coming up, we've also got Jennifer Harima from Royal Trucks rating the New York fucking Dolls, rock and roll high school director Alan Arkush gushing over his 10 favorite records of all time, both Vashti Bunyan and the Association rating the entirety of their own output, and Anthony Fantano, the origin story. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then with David Pajo. This is the last part. Slint and Such is what I'm calling it. It's Slint in addition to acts that I feel like you kind of have to take in the same breadth of consideration, which is King Kong and the Four Carnation.
Nice.
With the benefit of taking it all in at once, what I saw was this is your bar mitzvah. This is boys turning into men. There's so many ways for something like that to happen. The way in which it happened to you guys was like a thoroughly unique rite of passage.
Yeah, I mean, I can gush on and on about how Spider-Land changed everything for me, or just the whole Slint experience, and shaped my worldview and my view towards music and everything.
Let me ask first, are you sick to death of talking about this record?
I'm not, because they're my friends. And when I think of Slint, I think of Britt and Brian and Todd and Ethan. Yeah, I don't get sick of talking about it, because it truly was a collaboration. You know, even when Slint was around in the 80s, I would say that, like, I was Slint's biggest fan when nobody was our fan. You know, like, I always prided myself on being the biggest Slint fan, because I had all these other bands, but Slint was my real band. Like, I always thought of it as the real band, because we actually gave a shit about the songwriting.
Yeah. So in case you don't know who Slint are, and somehow you wound up listening to this podcast and you don't know who they are, I'm just going to humor you for a second and just explain that Slint is a major influence on bands like Mogwai, Godspeed You Black Emperor, Isis, Explosions in the Sky. PJ Harvey included it in her list of 10 favorites of all time. The same with Nastanovich from Pavement. It basically is considered the creator, truly, of the math rock genre, but it also stands apart from not just that genre, but really every genre. It is its own thing. I came across the record in 1991. It was an extremely impression-y time of my life. All the receptors were open. It was kind of like peeking on LSD, like everything became imprinted. So I came across you guys at the perfect time. The drugs were working. My head was lucid and clear, and I was ready to ingest and assimilate everything that you were throwing down. So there was Spider-Land sitting tauntingly upon the CD rack at 52 Brainerd Road in Alston, Massachusetts, and wound up seeing you guys live in 2005. When I think of you guys in the very beginning of listening to and allowing you guys to flip switches in the fuse box of my soul, I picture smoking weed this one night. I lived in a fraternity house, of all things. And I remember closing my eyes and listening to Don Imon and tripping out, picturing dinosaurs roaming and rampaging across landscapes. Yeah. I'll never forget that.
I love that. You asked me if I get sick of talking about Slint. Like, I love hearing people's personal connections to Spider-Land, because there is something really special about that band. Number one, it's the only band I've been in where I love all the fans. Like, I've never met a Slint band that was an idiot. Like, honestly, like, they all have been cool and I could hang out with them, you know? Yeah. I think it really filters out the world, you know? I feel like there should be a Slint question on all the dating apps, you know, where it's like, do you like Slint? And it's like, yes, no, who are that? What is this Slint?
There's certain bands as well that if it's a woman who likes them, you automatically marry her.
Yeah.
Noi and Can would be on that list.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know if I'm just kind of rambling here, but the cool thing about doing the reunions was that, in addition to like meeting the people who listened to Slint, that was great, but also like noticing that we toured in 2005, 2007 and 2014. So there's pretty long gaps in between there. By the time of the 2014, it has changed from older people to now younger people. People my age were bringing their teenage kids to the show who are bigger fans than their parents are. Even like, I went to Louisville last week and went to an all ages show. I haven't been to an all ages punk show in decades. And like, these really young kids would come up to me. This is surreal. I can't even believe I'm meeting you. You know, like, for me, it would probably be like hanging out with John Fahey or something, or like with Blind Willie McTell or something. That's the only way I can relate to it, because I know I'm just a dumbass deep down, but they don't know that.
We're all frauds.
Yeah. But like, it seemed like the audience has gotten really young, and I feel like that shows that it stood the test of time, because it speaks to the age group that we were when we made the album, which is so cool.
Yeah, it perpetually stands at that entranceway where a boy becomes a man.
Yeah.
It seems like you were unselfconscious about what it really meant, you know, in terms of its viability as a force to get you from point A, from being boys to actually being grown-up men.
And I always thought of it as like a male thing too. Like right now, I'm just thinking back, there were girls into Flint back in the 80s. We knew them all, and they were just like these really cool, empowered girls, really smart. And that's another thing I noticed is that as the tours went on, there was more of an equal, like, male to female ratio. Brian McMahon would joke that the only people that would be at our shows, we'd just see a sea of, like, bald heads and glasses, you know? Like, I think maybe it started off like that, but it really isn't like that now. It's like a younger and more diverse crowd, for sure.
I remember going to go see the Olivia Tremor Control at Maxwell's in Hoboken, and I remember looking around and feeling like I'm just one of so many bespectacled Caucasians.
I get that feeling too often. Yeah. But it's interesting to see that Flint seems to survive amongst all the trends and fashions that have come and gone.
Well, it stands outside of, it's impervious to being banged about by the styles of the day. So let's introduce the characters in today's episode. We have Brian McMahon on guitar and vocals, David Pajo himself on guitar, Britt Walford, drums and vocals, Todd Brashear, bassist on Spiderland, and Ethan Buckler, the bassist on Tweez. So here's a little section that is supposed to get us from point A to point B in as economical a time period as possible, called the run-up. And so correct me if I'm wrong on any counts here, but Slint was formed in 1986 in Louisville. Britt and Brian, those two met in their preteens, and it was total insanity from the moment they got together. They attended the Brown School, like a Montessori type of a deal, right?
Yep.
And they began performing music together real early, forming The Languid and Flaccid with Ned Oldham while they were still in middle school. In their teens, the two of them played together along with David Grubbs and Clark Johnson, and eventually Peter Searcy, replacing Grubbs on vocals in Squirrel Bait. And then Britt left the band after the first recording session in July 84. Brian went on to tour and record Squirrel Bait's two albums before they dissolved in 87. So your best friend, Mike Bukayu, played bass for Maurice. So then you started attending their practices, right?
Yeah.
Britt was 14. Brian was 14. Were you as well? You were 14?
I think I'm a year older than them.
What do you remember about being at those practices?
At Maurice practice? Oh, man. I remember seeing Britt play drums for the first time, and he was by far the best drummer I'd ever seen. He was just a monster, you know, the skinny little white guy, like, who could destroy on this kit. Like, you couldn't see him at all. The kit was bigger than he was. But, you know, Languid and Flaccid, he was playing drums with them when he was 11. They literally were going to hardcore shows, seeing the next Necros and all these bands from 82 and 83. They hadn't hit puberty yet. Kind of mind blowing.
It is.
But yeah, the main thing I remember was I was just getting into punk rock, and Britt was a monster. And the singer, we call him Rat, his name's Sean Garrison. He wouldn't show up at practice, but when he did, he would just kind of like walk around and scream to himself. He would pull out handfuls of hair. I was like, oh God, punk rock is insane. This shit is crazy.
So during this time, you and Britt are influenced by the Minutemen. As you've personally described it, the music direction became too clean and dorky for the other men. So basically, the Minutemen's influence wound up being the linchpin for the breakup of Maurice, right?
Yeah, and it really was. I think Rat says it on the documentary. The last Maurice song became the first Slint song. That is what happened. We just called it New Dave. It was like me trying to write a Minutemen song. It was real jazzy, and then it came out on Tweez as Pat, maybe.
So you guys form in the summer of 86. Will Oldham almost joined, but at that point, I think he had just picked up a guitar for the first time. So it probably sounded good on paper. But man, the quantum physics peak down that hallway is definitely interesting. So man, that would have been an interesting band. But kind of thank God it didn't happen as well. So Britt and you were joined by Ethan, who was slightly older, right? He was 18 at the time.
Well, he was my age. We were in the same class. I think he was, in 86, I think he was still 16.
Your first show is kind of legendary. You really got to watch the Slint documentary, the Lance Bangs one, to hear the whole tale. It really is this incredible story.
Yeah. You know, at the time, it was still just me and Britt and Ethan. You know, Maurice was broken up. We didn't have bands. And Ethan and I wanted to start something that was really different. And I was like, man, you should talk to Britt because I think he's in the same mindset as us. And they immediately hit it off and became best friends and playing pranks on poor victims. And we started playing as Slynn, but we were a trio.
That night you performed under the name Small, Dirty, Tight, Tufts of Hair, : Beads.
Our first show was at a Unitarian church, which right. Ethan's dad was a part of. Brian was there, yeah.
And he recorded it on mini cassette.
I remember because he played it for me afterwards. And I was so surprised that he loved it. I always thought everyone in Squirrelbait thought I was an idiot, which they probably did, because Maurice was such a metallic shredder kind of band, you know, and heavy. And Brian was such a huge fan of us as a trio. I was really shocked, you know. I was like, this is so cool that Brian likes it. Yeah, we played this Unitarian church. We played the opening when the priest walks down the aisle, and we were set up on the altar. So, like, and Will was there. He just kept the kick drum from sliding. He just sat in front of the kick drum. And very few people were there from our crew. Like, my girlfriend was there, I think, and Brian and Will, and that was about it. And we were so loud. Most of our songs were based on feedback. So we played when the priest walks down, we played during the meditation, and then we played again when the priest walks off. And by then, we'd scared off the old ladies and the little kids and stuff, you know, because we only had those three songs. But when they asked for what the name of the band was, because they have a little brochure of every week of what's happening and what the lecture is about and stuff. And Britt came up with Small, Tight, Dirty, Tufts of Hair, : Beads. Which looks hilarious in the brochure.
I mean, the : beads part, man, that is just
so offensive.
So then you guys get together and record a record. Steve Albini produces it because he had just left Big Black. And that brings us into phase one, what I'm calling Fart Jokes and Happy Accidents, 1987 to 1989.
Yeah.
In the autumn of 1987, you guys record Tweeze. It then comes out 2 years later in July of 89. The record is really kind of EP length, actually. It's just under 30 minutes. You know, I know that Jennifer Hartman was your friend. I know the label was set up to release the record expressly, but I guess she just called it Jennifer Hartman Records, right?
She just gave us money, basically. She didn't even run a label, but we thought it would be funny, you know, and then joke and showing gratitude to her to put her name on there. So we called it Jennifer Hartman Records and Tapes. So if there even though there are no tapes.
If there was no Jennifer Hartman, there potentially might not even be a Slynn. Would we not even be having this conversation?
There would be Slynn, but I don't know if there would be a recorded output. Yeah, we definitely would have still existed, regardless of if, you know, we recorded or not.
What a niceness, though. I mean, talk about being instrumental to your career. So this is the only record by you guys to feature Ethan Buckler, recorded in Evanston, Illinois, produced by Albini, like we said, and reissued by Touch and Go in 93. After Spiderland began to gather steam. For anyone who's not heard the record, it's got its own unique thing to it. It's primarily an instrumental thing. All the song titles are named after the band's parents, and which is great because I think the in-joke was these are the last kinds of songs that would be, you know, named for these people.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah. And it was also to thank them because they also contributed money to help us to pay for the recording and stuff. So
yeah.
It was also a tip of the hat to them.
I've heard this record a million times. It's a very interesting record because for the life of me, I would not be able to hum these songs to you. I've heard the record so many times.
Yeah.
The crazy thing about it is that it is so slippery. It's very Eel-like in the sense that I can never really get a grasp on it.
I think a lot of that was because we were still in that Maurice kind of world where, you know, there was no thought about appealing to people or like making any kind of structure that was relatable. There's a song on there. Maybe it's the second song on side two. It's all clean guitar, but it's called Nanding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so weird. I heard it recently.
I love that song.
But it's a really nice little compact, bizarre song.
Is that the one that goes dun, 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 dun?
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that because it becomes really hectic in certain sections. And then that, as a song, seems to have its own innate capacity to calm itself down.
Yeah, yeah. It has an intro and an ending and, you know, it has all the parts of a complete song, but it's so short. It is sort of in the Minutemen style of compacting a lot of ideas in a short period of time.
Yeah.
And also like just how hyperactive our minds were. Like my mind doesn't move that fast anymore.
Well, we're old men now.
Yeah.
The strange and incredible thing about this record is that you have these songs that are, or these pieces that are very tricky and very well worked out. And then you have the lyrical aspect of the record, which is so tossed off and in the moment that it's almost shocking. Ron is the perfect example. I think that's Britt talking with Steve about, you know, are the headphones on or off?
Oh, that's Brian. Yeah.
That's Brian. Okay. The vibe of the words being not just an afterthought, but almost derisively, like, I guess we'll do something here versus the loops that you guys are hypnotically, you know, you can see in Breadcrumb Trail, caught in this compulsive loop of playing this stuff over and over and perfecting it. So what was the idea of Fuck Lyrics after working so hard on the music?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we worked only on the music. And I think the lyrics for Tweez especially were such a last minute thing. And it was for Spiderland too, really.
All you guys were on the same page about let's perfect the music and then the lyrics can go fuck themselves?
Yeah, we never thought about lyrics. I mean, we never thought about vocals on the songs. It was 100% just about making these instrumentals, I guess, you know? And I don't want to jump ahead too much, but by the time we got to Spiderland, Good Morning Captain was the only song where we had considered leaving some space for vocals. And even Washer, I think we left some space for vocals, but if there weren't vocals, that was fine too. It really was an afterthought. When we went in to do Tweez, I think we wanted to experiment in the studio. I'd never been in a big studio before with someone who knew what they were doing and understood our kind of music. So it was really exciting. And we just wanted to try it all. At least Britt and Brian and I did. We wanted to experiment with everything. And we didn't want to sound like a Big Black record. Britt and Brian and I loved Big Black so much. But we knew with Steve, we didn't want it to sound like a Big Black record. And plus, some of the songs were more Big Black influenced. So we didn't want a normal Albini production. We wanted him to walk the plank a little bit too and get on the edge. And so we did some really wacky things in the studio for every song, really. Even the first song where he talks about the headphone. Because Brian was doing the vocal take and he was just complaining about the headphones, but he also had the vocals were recorded by having two mics on each side of his head, like swinging past his ears. And so he'd have to keep them moving. He'd have to give them little pushes so that they'd be swinging. And that's how the vocals were recorded. I think he finally got so pissed off that the headphones were screwed up that he started smacking the headphones against the music stand that had his lyrics on it, you know? So all that stuff, we were like, let's use it, you know? Let's make that part of the song. We were definitely more experimental in the studio than any other record, with Slint at least.
In the quantum physics alternate worlds theory that you guys broke up before Spiderland was worked on or came out, what would the legacy of Slint be if all that you released was Tweez?
I think we would have just been seen as an obscure band that was influenced by Big Black. I think Spiderland really legitimized, or like that's what people liked about Slint, were like about Slint. And if that had never happened, I don't think people would pay much attention to Tweez, even though musically the songs aren't as dissimilar as it seems, because the vast difference in production between Tweez and Spiderland makes people think that there was this huge change that happened. But when we did the 2005 tour, maybe you remember this, we really wanted to play Tweez songs just as much as Spiderland. And so we mixed them into the set, we mixed them in with them. And it all sounds like the same band. It all sounds cohesive. It's not like, whoa, that's a whole different kind of song right there, you know, except for maybe the Minutemen one, the jazzier one. But
this does have its own separate and distinct vibe, much to your credit.
Yeah, it does. I think that's more production stuff than actual songwriting. Although we never made ourselves vulnerable on that record either, lyrically. So
yeah, well, that could have been part of the side effects of having the anal breathing tape on there.
Yeah, we were always scatologically,
and that's the real reason why, with a straight face, I'm calling this phase fart jokes and happy accidents, is you guys, especially with the story behind that tape, you guys really are kids becoming men in the studio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That kind of scatological thing. I still have an outgrown toilet humor.
I know. I still think fart sounds are really funny. I always imagine them only happening in elevators or church or like someplace where they're not supposed to. So it always makes me laugh. But man, my kids don't think it's funny at all. How can you not think a fart is funny? And they're just like, oh, they're gross. I'm glad they didn't inherit that from me.
Great or hysterical about a fart, for God's sake. But, you know, look, just as an overall for Tweez, no matter how many times I listen to the record, I can never, ever remember the individual tunes as such. Only the mood of the overall record stays with me. And to me, that's both its strength and just for me, if it has any weakness, that would be it for me. In an even odder twist, Tweez feels as tossed off and improvised as Spiderland feels incredibly well-constructed and thought out. And that's why Tweez is always so surprising to me, or feels like I must have missed something. It's totally legendary, but nothing's untouchable unless it's just encased and ossified in mythology. So to break this sucker out of its case and parse it for real, if you had just released this record, you know, you wouldn't have been legends, but it certainly would have been a strong footnote. If you could go back and tweak this, would you tweak it or would you leave it exactly as is?
I mean, I kind of think of records now as like tattoos, you know, you can regret them if you want, but you kind of have to just accept that it's just evidence of a mindset you once had or a time period you once had. So I don't think I would change anything, but I would be curious to hear it without all the effects and just the bare tracks. Britt and Todd and I did an interview recently. Someone had mentioned, like, what if Ethan had mixed Tweez? Like, what would it sound like? And we were all like, I would be really curious to hear. Because, you know, you were probably going to get to this, but of course, Ethan was really unhappy with that recording. He said it didn't capture everything he loved about Slint. I wouldn't change the songs or the record, but I would be curious to hear Ethan's interpretation of that record or like that time period. But who knows if that'll ever happen.
Well, I'm going to give Tweez, out of 5 stars, I'm going to give it 4. I didn't go through and rate any of your solo career stuff, but for Slint, I'm going to hew towards the rules that I usually use for the traditional Discograffiti episode. So I'm going to give this 4 stars.
Wow, that's generous.
Well, what would you give it?
I don't know. I would give it a 3, maybe. I don't think it sucks at all, but I think it is maybe... The songwriting is crowded by the production. And that's not Albini's fault. We wanted him to do that. Yeah, I think in the documentary, he takes the blame. But Britt and Brian and I encouraged him to experiment and have fun with ideas. So it's not his fault.
I'm definitely glad. And I love him as a producer. But man, am I glad you guys showed him the exit after this. You got the right guy on board, basically.
Yeah.
You really did. And so, you know, after it was done, Ethan was dissatisfied with the recordings and left Slint to form King Kong. So movie star is basically Slint. Or not basically, movie star is Slint.
Yeah, it's the band members. But I think I played drums on the Camel Walk song and maybe one other song. And there's one song that has a wah-wah on it. And I think maybe Brian's playing guitar, or maybe Britt's playing guitar and Brian's just doing the wah-wah. it's so all over the place. I don't know if I would say it's Slint because we don't always play the instruments that we're the most comfortable on.
Right.
As far as members, yeah.
King Kong's always been a strange proposition for me. I can only guess with its placement during the end credits of Breadcrumb Trail that there is a very personal aspect of Movie Star to you guys. Am I reading into that? Or how does Movie Star fit in to the Slint tale?
That was Lance's choice. It is a really good one because it's, you know, all of us when we were a more innocent version of ourselves and more naive, I suppose. You know, we were just still kids, basically, when we made Movie Star. And then it's in a movie where we're not movie stars, but, you know, it's getting this recognition that we never had. Plus, I just love that song. I thought that was a really good placement of that song.
Full disclosure, I'm not a King Kong fan. You know, I got Me Hungry a long time ago. And I was flummoxed as to how tossed off it was. But the song Movie Star is a whole different thing. I mean, That song is truly intense and a one-off as far as vibe goes. So that was recorded in Steve Albini's studio while he was away on a trip in 89. And this is the first release by King Kong. It's the Movie Star EP. And it is Ethan, you, Britt, and Brian. But, you know, through the life of the band, King Kong would go on to feature John McIntyre, David Grubbs, Peter Townsend.
Yeah.
But this is basically Slint, except in name. And, for me, Movie Star, it's a total classic, propulsive and intense in a way that I feel like Tweez kind of wasn't. So is this wish fulfillment or is it just making fun of a certain way of thinking lyrically?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's making fun of it. I mean, you'll have to ask Ethan, but I always thought he was making fun of Movie Stars and maybe their simplistic mindset or something. Like he later had a song called Businessman that did the same thing, I felt like. King Kong is a strange one.
So Movie Star, I'm going to give that EP 3.5 stars.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Mainly because the song itself is staggeringly good. And then the Camel's Walk song and Chicken Shit, for me, it diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Chicken Shit especially sounds like a Primus instrumental. And I'm only saying that because you're not in punching distance of me.
No, I can see that. Like, I'm trying to imagine it because I always like the strong drums that Britt plays on that. And he's also doing the chicken sound. I always thought that was pretty funny.
What do you give this one?
I love King Kong and I love early King Kong, especially. I would give it a 4 or 4.5, Ethan.
Nice. Okay. So you're higher on this one. You're lower than me on Tweez. It's at this point where Todd Brashear comes into the band and we are thus on phase two. Hey, lads and ladies, Dave Gebro here. I abandoned my career and moved my family 3,000 miles to be able to focus exclusively on Discog Graffiti. And so if you're like me, and enough is just never enough, then please visit patreon.com/discograffiti and become one of our Patreon soldiers of sound. Discog Graffiti is an entirely listener-supported show, and it's also intended to be a 3 times a week music deep dive experience. So do us both a favor and consider giving it a shot. Trust me, I'm working hard for the money, so hard for it, honey. There's the main show on Friday, a Monday wildcard episode, which is either a soul-bearing interview with that week's special guest, or an offshoot show like Queasy Listening and Rock Cousteau. And then on Wednesdays, there's the humdinger of them all, Discog Graffiti's The Private Press with Paul Major. You got nothing to lose. If you don't dig it after a month, you're refunded. No questions asked. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti. Phase two, Kids Stumbling Upon a Darkness, 1989 to 1994. And the first thing we have here is not by release date, but by recording date. It's the self-titled Slint EP, recorded in spring 89, released in 94. And these were recorded with Steve Albini. So there's the unreleased song Glenn and a reinterpretation of Rhoda from Tweez. They were intended to be released as a 12-inch single on Jennifer Hartman's record label, which, of course, was just for you guys. So these are purely instrumental. There's no even last-minute spoken word stuff on this. So what's your vibe about this material? This is probably the least spoken about Slint release.
I love the EP. You know, it came out after Spiderland, but it was, like you said, it was recorded in between Tweez and Spiderland. It was basically during this period of a year or maybe a year and a half where we were just practicing all the time. We just practiced a lot and we were just working on what became Spiderland. But at some point during that interim, Albini had said, like, I have this studio time in Chicago where, you know, this band Barbecue Killers canceled on me, but I still have the studio for one night. Like, he was calling every band he knew to see if they could take it. We were like, yeah, let's do it. Rhoda, we'd never played before Tweez. Like, that was another Britt thing where we learned it, like, right before the recording, maybe. I remember Britt had to play the bass on it because we had to tape over Ethan's one because he couldn't. It was such a weird bass line. But so we went up there for one night to record the current version of Rhoda that we had that was an actual band version. And one of our new songs, which was Glenn, which we named after Todd's parents because he just joined the band. Todd's dad. And that was it. Like, we recorded and mixed it in one night and drove home. And then that didn't come out until after we'd broken up, and we remixed it with Brian Paulson at Albini's studio. Gosh, that sounds so convoluted.
You know, you guys are the kind of band that people are desperately hanging on to every last second of material because there's so little.
Yeah.
And this is certainly, you know, thank God that this is actually of a high standard, high caliber, because everyone's wanting everything. But it is really good. I love this material. I think Glenn especially is a perfect middle ground between the sort of dashed off inspiration of Tweeze and the fully worked out, almost nothing left to chance perfection of Spiderland.
Yeah.
Although it's the last release of yours that I think of when I think of the band, it's also an essential stepping stone to understanding how you guys got from point A to point B.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good point, because that's a snapshot of where, when we were in that transition, because we really wanted to be on Touch and Go. After we recorded Tweeze, we actually made maybe 40 cassettes that we gave away. And the idea, we were hoping that Corey from Touch and Go would hear it and want to put us out, but he didn't like Tweeze at the time. To him, it sounded like a big black ripoff band. It wasn't until he heard when we did Glenn, and I think he'd heard it live before he heard the recorded version, but when he saw us live and we played that song, he said that's when he was like, wow, this is the band that I like this band. Yeah. Now I don't want to put it out. That was a transitionary recording for sure. I'm glad that we have that exists, because, you know, you can tell that we're it's bridging the gap.
I give this one 4 stars. Where are you at with this one rating-wise?
Man, it's hard for me to rate Slant. I mean, I love the EP, especially the cover, because that was Brian McMahon like executing a crazy idea he had, like a whole story for the album cover. And he set up the whole shot like at a proper photography studio, and he rented a police uniform. There's a whole story there, like the dead guy with the gun. There's a kid, that's a little kid standing there. And then there's a cop on the other corner, and the shadows and the fake snow and everything. I would give it a 5 just for the album cover.
Nice. Yeah. The only recorded evidence of Slint in 1990, to my knowledge, is the Spiderland prep stuff off the box. So there's a few 4-track demos, Washer, Nosferatu Man, Pam Again, Good Morning Captain, a couple Basement Practice tunes, Nosferatu Man and Washer. And man, this sounds like you guys were caught captive by the grooves that you'd established, and that the songs themselves were holding you hostage, because they sound exactly like the studio versions. So at this point, it feels not like you're practicing, but that the songs literally have a chokehold on you. And you have no choice but to be playing them ad infinitum.
Yeah. There was only one way to play the songs once we had decided on that way. You know, all the practices were for trying out ideas of different ways of playing a section or a bass line or a guitar part or arrangement. But once we all agreed on how it should be, then it was like we were held captive by the songs, in the sense that the only way to play it right was to play it exactly the same, play it exactly like that.
And also the only way to play it right is to never stop playing it, right?
Yeah. You have to practice like crazy to play it right all the way through.
3 years wound up passing between the recording of Tweeze and Spiderland. A lot of people don't think about that or don't keep that in mind necessarily when they look at it, but that's a long time. It's a long time if you're anybody, but if you're a teenager and you're going through guises quicker than 70s Bowie and in a much more organic way than just choosing a mask, then it's a very long time.
Yeah.
First thing to really explore, the first thing you see or notice about the record, there's no album title, there's no band title. There's just 4 guys floating in a quarry, seemingly without any effort, like you're a gang of buoys. There's certain album covers that really you can look at endlessly. And my very first memory I ever had was, it's like there was darkness, and then all of a sudden, I am parsing Beatles album covers for clues.
Right, yeah.
Really, that's how it all began. And so yours is one of those records where, you know, you could just look at it unendingly. I'm not the only person who feels this way, obviously, because it helped to beget a large chunk of the mythology that surrounds your band.
Yeah, the album art.
Did any forethought go into the shooting of that?
Not into the shooting. Like, Will shot two rolls of film on us. And the point was we needed promo photos because we were going to tour Europe. And they asked us for promo photos and we didn't have any. So we went out with Will. We went to this old hotel called the Galt House and shot some stuff there.
It's just funny how life works, because it's just a photo of a bunch of guys in a lake, and yet somehow you see it and you're like, boom, yeah, that's it. It's so obviously it.
We had like this stack of photos to choose from for an album cover, and we all chose a couple. Like, Britt chose some, I chose some. I didn't choose that one. And I think Brian was the one that convinced us that that should be the album cover.
What did you want?
I wanted a different quarry. There was another quarry one, but it was in focus. It's what ended up being on the Breadcrumb Trail poster, I think, in the box set too. It's just like a variation, but it's all like in focus. And I liked that one better. I was like, why would you want the blurry one? And Britta chose a different one where we're also in the quarry, but we're looking down on it. And it looks like, because of the reflections in the water, our bodies look distorted. He liked that one. And I remember not liking that one. And again, like doubting Brian, who is the only one who seemed to have the foresight then. We really thought that should be it. And I did like it because we're smiling, but I also didn't know that that was going to be the end of the band. I think he knew that he was quitting. And so he probably wanted it as a statement, but we all thought we were going on tour in Europe. That was the next thing after this record comes out. But like literally after I finished the artwork, this is the old days when you had to get the photo printed out, the size that it was going to be on the album. And I had to put it on this hard board. I laid it all out. And we had the band name and all this stuff. We had more text on it. But Brian and I would sit there and be like, that doesn't look good. And we'd start moving stuff around, taking stuff away. And we kept taking stuff away until that was all that was left, you know? And that's exactly our approach to the songs.
You know, that aesthetic really brings to mind the creative process of Mark Hollis. And so, you know, the end of the line for that kind of thing is total silence. I think that's where he was heading, and maybe where you guys were heading. The amount of space, for example, that's in the Four Carnation Fight Songs EP.
Yeah.
Starts to get like, whoa, expansive, really expansive.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that silence is the final result. That's a good way of putting it. And it was so refreshing to me. I mean, that's why I've always loved Slint, was that I felt like we did the opposite of what other bands did. Instead of piling stuff on and making things dense, we were always stripping stuff off and throwing away stuff. I remember Brian Paulson laughing, and when we recorded Spiderland, we asked him to do something. He started laughing. He was like, you guys are the only band where the guitar player asked to be turned down, you know, like where, and the drummer asked for the drums to be just quieter, you know, like every other band, like every band member wants to make themselves louder, you know.
Right.
For us, it was never an ego thing. It was always about the final product being bigger than any of our egos.
Are you falling in step as far as what you guys are listening to as a band during this time? Or are you all coming to the table with completely different influences? I've read The Pool was Gang of Four, Black Sabbath, and Sonic Youth, but maybe I'm totally wrong.
I think that would be more applicable to Tweez. I think by the time we had gotten to Spiderland, I mean, we did one tour in 1989, and it was basically it wasn't even a tour. It was like five or six shows with a break in the middle. And the music we listened to in the van, we all had our own styles that we liked, you know, like we all had our own identities, but we definitely all met in the same place. And I'd say the bands that we all met in the same place with were AC/DC, Rolling Stones, old Delta Blues and old country, and the Mekons. Yeah, it was our musical influences had widened, or we were more open about the music we really liked, you know?
Yeah.
Because Bruce Springsteen was in there, and Nick Drake, and Leonard Cohen, and Nick Cave.
Yep. So the lyric approach here, a little bit more considered. So what I'm led to believe was the process here was, I guess, just by listening to Brian himself in the film. Brian would listen to the rehearsal tapes in his parents' car in the garage at his house, and come up with the spoken word ideas there on a four track. And it would be the summers, so there'd be like sweat pouring down his face while he's doing this. And then you guys get to the joint and recorded it. You set up on a Friday after work, like end of day Friday, and you're out of there by Sunday. So it was like 48 hours. And then before that even wound up happening, Brian took a trip out there to meet with Brian Paulson, and he was hit by a car and nearly killed, which was, you know, maybe the black cloud that was hanging over the record, you know, the mortality.
The car accident, I'd forgotten all about it, but when Lance heard about it, he thought it was a big deal that should be in the film. And I think all of us were sort of confused, I guess, because Brian didn't think it was a big deal at the time and was so casual about it happening, but it was a serious accident. But I'm pretty sure that was after we had recorded Spiderland, or maybe it was before.
Yeah, I think you had the songs, but it wasn't recorded yet.
Oh, that's probably what it was, yeah.
But, you know, I can't help but wonder how much of that incident wound up informing at least the mood of the final result, or not, or it was just something that happened.
I didn't think so, but maybe it was a bigger deal for Brian and made him confront his mortality or something.
I never understood. I mean, so Britt and Brian both are massive, major, major talents. And yeah. I really don't understand the trajectory of their careers. First of all, they feel like intentionally zigzaggy instead of there being a through line where you can reduce what they've done into an easily definable thing. Both of those guys, you know, like the way that your career is so rife with material, I wish to God there was more like that in both of their discographies.
Well, it's funny you say that because I feel like ever since Slint, since 1990 or whatever, ever since we broke up, I feel like it's been my job, since I've been in the public eye more, to prop them up more and give them all the credit, because I feel like maybe they're willfully obscure, but I feel like I have to champion them because, you know, I definitely don't want to I don't even like speaking for Slint, because I feel like I was 1/4 of the band, like we all were.
Yeah.
But I do feel this need to diminish myself a little bit and prop them up any chance I can get. It's funny, I went to Louisville with my daughter last week to visit my dad, who's in a nursing home now and stuff. And I was like, okay, you've met this guy before, but you're really young. And I didn't realize it, but she was like, are all your friends geniuses? Because every time you describe them, you always say that they're a genius. and I'm like, I think all my friends are geniuses.
Your friends are geniuses.
Yeah.
You know, with Brian and Britt, the two of those guys feel like the kinds of geniuses where it's like, sort of, is there a self-defeating aspect to it? Because I don't know, it seems like their discographies could be explosively huge, especially coming off of Slint. Let's just focus on Brian for a second. The direction he was taking with Fight Songs, which we'll get to momentarily, but I feel like he had his finger on a similar kind of pulse that Dylan had, like during Blonde on Blonde, where he was just coming up with these cinematic images, like the assassins and burn victims.
Yeah, man, that's a really good analogy.
Holy shit, it's just like, oh my God, like almost unbearably intense, some of this stuff. And then, to be frank, I don't know where he went. I don't know a tremendous amount about his personal life, but man, major talents.
Everything that you and I love about their output still exists. You know, like I'll get an email from Brian or something, and there'll be some wording or something in there that just really hits me. Like I'm glad it's not just me that really connects with what I think they do best.
I get sometimes pissed off thinking about it, that I don't know why that road was not driven down or what have you.
Yeah, I hear you for sure. Well, it's not over yet and there's still time, but man, if you really want to get into the psychology of the individual members of Slint, it's a real rabbit hole, because one thing that Todd and I have figured out is that basically every member of the band has their mental problems.
Yeah. There's like a mythological vapor that surrounds the completion of the record. You know, there's the vibe that everyone, or not even a vibe, but I remember being told that, you know, everybody had a nervous breakdown and then the recording was finished. And I mean, you know, this is of course back pre-internet, so it's wraps of information. Is some of that stuff played up for a similar reason why Bon Iver would, you know, want to have the cabin story? All right, that about does it. A heartfelt discography thanks goes out to our graphic designer, Todd Zimmer, my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, David Pajo, Drag City, Jeff Kamara for hooking this thing up, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, not in a romantic way, sorry, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers. Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator, and much more. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com or contact me through Instagram and I'll keep you regular, as it were. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper is to get thee directly to the David Pajo series beginning, which starts at number 94. Not to mention the Pavement series and the Lou Barlow series, where I Gen X'd myself half to death from episodes 49 to 62 with the help of Lou himself and the awesome Bob Nastanovich. Also, episode 12 is PJ Harvey, episode 18 is Pixies, and episode 30 is Nirvana. But wait just a minute. This is just the entrance to the rabbit hole. Join us as we descend down, down, down on Discography's week-long Pajo Peyote 3 deep dive. Of course, if you're a Patreon subscriber, then you already know to keep your ears peeled throughout the week, because this Monday brings the Patreon-only wildcard episode, the David Pajo Patreon Collection, Volume 4, in which he explains why the Minutemen truly embodied the punk spirit, not to mention a more detailed overview of King Kong's origin story and Pajo's definition of the particular specific insanity that comes only with lieu of a living, not to mention Wednesday's incredible Patreon-only episode of Discography's The Private Press, which is part three of our four-part interview series with Texan psych legend Bill Miller about his insanely great band Cold Sun. If you don't know him and you feel like maybe you could just skip it, I want you to picture the underground bunker that literally was built to house this record down in Corpus Christi, Texas, by legendary man of terrific music taste, Ashley Johnson, seeing as you don't want to fuck around down in hurricane country when you possess the only copy ever made of one of the greatest records of all time. Yeah, you heard me right. Make sure you visit patreon.com/discography and check out the deep dive as a music obsessive's way of life. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, June 23rd, we're coming at you with the final interview in the David Pajo series. It's the Spiderland episode, part 5, and the action-packed conclusion of Discography's 9-hour holy shit interview with the man himself. And so, from now till then, happy 100, motherfuckers! Don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies! It's Discography!